Before we get started, I want to involve you in a quick survey. So how many of you are trained as a clinician and have ever in your lives treated a person with stroke? Wow. Pretty much everybody. How many people have ever gotten the sense that their stroke patients did not get enough rehabilitation, enough therapy? Pretty much everybody. And how many people, if they could give extra rehabilitation to a patient, we'd give it at one of three, you have to pick one of three time periods after stroke. Early, in the first couple, 3 weeks after stroke onset, in the U.S., people are in inpatient rehabilitation. I'm talking to Dr. Becker yesterday, that's true in Norway as well. So that's the first choice. You could give them more then. The second choice is to give them more once they become an outpatient. In the U.S., that's about 6 weeks, 2 months, somewhere in there. And the third choice is when they're chronic, say 6 months out or perhaps a year out. So those are the three choices: early during inpatient, medium during outpatient, later as a chronic, a person with chronic stroke. So how many people say early? Okay, about a third. How many people say medium during the outpatient phase? More. How many people say chronic? Also about as many as say early. This is the definition of clinical equipoise, where we don't know what the right, whether there's an effect in timing, and what the optimal time would be. And so that's most of the talk that I will give today. We saw virtuoso science yesterday. The talks we saw yesterday, I have seen them before, these speakers before, and they always blow me away with the precision and the care with which the experiments that they do are performed. I am a clinician, and my experiments are much less precise and clear because it's a different setting. And so my goals are slightly different. The goals for this talk are first, because many of you are therapists, are to remind you that there are treatments to improve the lives of people with stroke that do not involve motor training, language training, or activity-based therapies. We're just going to list them very quickly just to remind you of them. But as a physician, I think about these a lot. The second is rehabilitation research, and by that I mean these activity-based therapies, these motor training paradigms, these language training paradigms, and so forth. There are certain targets that we can address in rehabilitation. And then finally, I want to walk you through the process that we used to translate one rodent experiment into a small, single-center-based clinical trial. We had to make some decisions. These experiments are beautiful in the rodents. They truly are. But if you're going to do them in humans, if you're somebody like me, and perhaps somebody like many of you in the room here, you have to make some decisions about how to translate those choices into a clinical trial. And I'll point out that I am a scientist, and I do science in my patients whenever possible. But my overall goal is really to make rehabilitation rational, because there are many irrational things about rehabilitation, and to make it optimally effective, because that's, you know, as a clinician, that's one of my goals. I've chosen, rather than tearing down the rehabilitation system trying to rebuild it, to work within the existing structures that I work in the United States. So a fairly conservative approach about dealing with the healthcare system. Okay, enough of that. Let's talk about the context here, putting rehabilitation interventions that, you know, people in this room are interested in a slightly larger context. So you probably know that stroke is one of the most common causes of disability in the world. It's the second leading cause of death in the world. As we're getting better and better at helping stroke patients survive, that means, and as the baby boomer cohort born after World War II is aging into their primary stroke age, that means that, and I'm one of them, there will be more and more disability related to stroke in the world, and this will become a larger and larger problem. It will be a somewhat smaller problem in wealthy countries such as in Scandinavia and North America, but a problem nonetheless. And in the United States, we're planning that between 2010 and 2030, that the costs related to stroke will triple. And that's because the aging of the baby boomer cohort. So thinking about how to make stroke patients better, this is very simple, and this is an MRI scan of a person with a right middle cerebral artery stroke. Actually, it's a child with a right middle cerebral artery stroke, but that's a different talk. If looking at it as a physician, the first thing that I'm interested in when I work as an acute stroke neurologist is making the lesion smaller, and I can do that with drugs such as tissue plasminogen activator, which dissolves the clot and restores blood flow to the brain. That has to be done very early after stroke, within 4.5 hours of symptom onset. If it's not going in within 4.5 hours, then we don't use it because the risk is too high. We can also now, in the last 2 years, endovascular treatments, where we insert a catheter. We is not me. I don't do this personally. Insert a catheter into the arteries, thread it up into the brain, and actually remove the clot. The second thing that we can do as rehabilitationists is don't make the stroke bigger than it has to be. We can maintain perfusion of tissue that's at risk. A rounded stroke is something called the penumbra, and that's tissue that can go either way. It can recover, perhaps become functional again, or it can go on to die. If you think that activity-dependent lesion enlargement is a problem for humans with stroke, then moderating the amount of physical activity in the first day or two, or perhaps the first week or two, may be important. There have been many clinical trials addressing the issue of apoptosis. This is delayed cell death. So the tissue, much of the tissue dies within the first few minutes or few hours of loss of blood flow, but some of these fatal processes for neurons go on for days and even weeks. And so if you can stop those, at least then you could make the lesion prevented from growing. And then at some point, hopefully, we will be able to repair these injuries, either with transplanted cells or objects made out of silicon, some sort of brain machine interface. Okay. You can also target the rest of the brain. We discussed some of this yesterday. You can attempt to make the brain more plastic. Brain stimulation, at least in animal models, appears to change the anatomy related to plasticity. You can use drugs such as selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, maybe HDAC inhibitors, and even perhaps, we mentioned briefly Steve Zeiler's work at Hopkins, that additional brain lesions may actually reopen plasticity, at least in rodent models. We can alter the balance of excitation inhibition between the hemispheres. And again, this is a brain stimulation task for the most part. We can alter neurotransmitters in an advantageous way. We think that serotonin reuptake inhibitors, such as Prozac, may have a beneficial effect. Stimulants may have a beneficial effect. And finally, a more conservative goal for stem cell transplants is not to replace dead brain tissue, but to support the existing brain tissue to make it more functional. Okay, and then other things that happen a lot in a rehabilitation hospital in particular, optimizing the overall homeostasis of the person, treating fevers, monitoring blood glucose, brain perfusion. All of these things have been shown in animal models and indirectly in human studies to affect stroke outcome. Avoiding negatively avoiding moving neurotransmitters in the wrong direction, such as using dopamine blockers and certain anticonvulsants. Treating depression, increasing the self-efficacy of an individual, their belief in their ability to change their outcome, and altering the environment through enrichment, socialization, and so forth. And so all of these are the context in which we as rehabilitationists have the potential to improve the outcome of people with stroke. And then we can talk about what we all came here for, which is looking at some of these activity-based treatment interventions where we can look at specific aspects of these treatments. Okay, we can design studies that look at task specificity or practice schedule or engagement or consolidation, putting in a cognitive component, particularly problem solving, targeting treatments, determining which patients can respond to which treatments, actually have the capacity to respond to a treatment. And so all of these are things that we can investigate as researchers. Where I have spent my time in the last few years has been in timing effects in training, and specifically the amount of time spent in training and the timing of when treatment is optimally delivered. And so that's what I'm going to focus the rest of this talk on. Now, what I want you to remember is that the brain is a moving target, okay, in the first few weeks after stroke. You heard some of this yesterday about the local and distant effects of lesions and how there are alterations in brain anatomy and physiology that go on for weeks, if not months, and perhaps even years after the onset of the lesion. And so this is an old diagram. This is time after injury and the distance from the lesion. And basically, it's just a way of thinking about the effects of an injury. So the injury is not over at 3 hours. It's not over at 12 hours. It's not over at a week. It goes on for quite some time. We can look at, we can think about neuronal recovery, so the neurons that were injured but not actually killed. We can think about the immediate effects on synapse physiology, the effects on synaptic regeneration that take place days to weeks after the injury. And then later on, there is a little tiny bit of neurogenesis in adult humans. It's not clear whether it has any clinical utility or not. You heard about synaptic reorganization, and you heard about cortical remapping. So at any given point after the injury, the stroke is in a certain state, and that state evolves over time. It's a moving target. And if you look down at the genetic level, I'm surprised this slide is was not presented yesterday. Maybe it's just too old. Looking at patterns of gene expression after injury in animal models, the point here is not which genes are going up and down. It's what I want you to take away from this is that gene expression is going up and down. And so genes are being expressed at day 3, and then by day 7 they're starting to go down. Other ones, the expression starts at day 7 and peaks at day 14 and goes down at day 28. Again, the message here is that there's a cellular and a molecular basis for a moving target in those first few weeks after injury. Okay,
So this is a cartoon. This gentleman just had neurosurgery. He had a brain transplant. And it says, okay, sir, remember, that brain we gave you is only a temporary one, so don't think too hard with it. Don't burn it out. Okay. So, as a clinician and also now as a researcher, I begin to think about time epochs after stroke. So when I'm an acute stroke neurologist, for me, the tools that I have are available to me for about 12 hours, and that's it. Maybe up to 24 hours if we want to be optimistic. And so that's the first epoch. That doesn't really necessarily involve rehabilitation. A few days to a few weeks is where I spend most of my time in the U.S. That's the inpatient rehabilitation phase. And one thing we'll discuss a little bit is whether or not we need to more finely subdivide that few days to a few weeks. I'm being vague because we don't have data to support any, to really be clear about what these epochs are. Again, as a clinician working within the system, I know that the second phase of stroke rehabilitation is after the patient is discharged and they begin outpatient therapy. So that's another clinical window where we as a clinical discipline and as a society have made a choice about how we're going to treat those patients. How do we optimize that? And then a few months to forever. So there are issues around maintaining gains made, trying to increase the gains that that patients make, and issues around community participation and health maintenance. So in my opinion, each of these represents an opportunity. And it also represents a research question, meaning that what might be true at 12 hours is not true at 24 hours or 24 weeks. And so we cannot assume that what may end up being true in one of these time periods after stroke is true in all of them. And so in my simple-minded way, this is how I think about stroke rehabilitation research. So it's just a simple table, and all we have to do is fill it in. We've been working on it for a long time, all of us, but this is essentially, for me, the task of the field, where we have these different time epochs, and we have different treatments, and we have to do the clinical trials asking whether a particular treatment works in a particular time epoch, and what may work at a few days may not work at a few weeks or a few months, or may not work in chronic patients. And again, where I have focused my attention has been early after stroke in the first few days and few weeks, and basically focusing on activity-based therapies, either the content, the training paradigms being used, or the dosing, the amount, the time spent in therapy. And you can imagine as many rows in this table as you would like. You could have one for magnetic stimulation, another one for transcranial electrical stimulation. You could have one for every stem cell line you can think of, every transmitter modulator you can think of. And I would argue that although we don't have to fill in each cell, it may not make sense to try and fill in some of these cells from a scientific perspective. In essence, this is what the field is trying to do. So, let's talk about this early period. There is this concept of critical periods, which emerged from the 19th and 20th centuries in developmental biology. It's a very old idea. A critical period is a time during an organism's lifespan when it is more sensitive to environmental influences or stimulation or activity than at other times during its life. So, you probably know the story of the cats and the visual system, Google and Weasel, where if the cat's visual system was manipulated beyond a certain time point, the cat's vision simply never developed normally because the critical period had passed. Similarly, in second language learning, my colleague Alyssa Newport has done a lot of work in this, that by age 7, if you have not learned your second language, you will never speak it as a native speaker. And so in the U.S., of course, we wait until the children are 12 or 14 to start teaching them language, which is why people in the U.S. can only speak English. We're not immersed in as many languages as Europeans are. And I would rather than calling it a critical period, which suggests certain properties, that it's an abrupt turning on and an abrupt turning off, and it's a black and white phenomenon. Either you can learn a second language or you can't learn a second language. A sensitive period is a softer version of that. There's usually a slope where there is increasing opportunity to accomplish the developmental task and then a slowly decreasing opportunity. And it's not black and white. You can still learn that language. You just can't learn it as well as a native speaker. And so really we should be talking about, I think we should be talking about sensitive periods, not critical periods. Now in the brain, normal development, remember that roughly at the time of birth, you have all the neurons you're ever going to have, and they begin to die off very quickly in the Darwinian selection process. During that normal brain development, there are expressions of genetic programs that drive the development of the nervous system. Superimposed upon that are things such as experience, sensory input, and environment. And these things affect which neurons survive and which synapses are formed. And because of this time at, during development, the developing brain has the capacity to adapt to current demands and to circumstances. So a mother treats the child one way versus another way. The child is injured. You can think of 100 different influences. The child is on a medication. These things, the cellular mechanisms of these things are being worked out in pretty good detail, looking at epigenetic modulation of gene expression, meaning modifications of the gene to turn the gene expression upregulated or downregulated, the responsiveness of axons to guidance molecules as they're trying to go to their connection that they want to go to. There's neuronal competition for trophic factors. For a neuron to survive, it must have a connection. There's adjustment of networks to variations in input. A child who's deprived of language, their language system will develop differently than a child who is immersed in language, as most children are. And reorganization after insult or injury. Remember I told you that MRI I showed you was actually of a child who had a stroke at the time of birth. Those children, in case you're not aware of this, go on to have remarkably good recoveries, far better than adults. So the injury that would kill me, that total right middle cerebral artery stroke, for them, leaves them with a residual hemiparesis. They definitely have a hemiparesis, but their cognitive abilities tested within normal limits, within the normal range. They're lower than their siblings, but they're within normal range. And so at the time of birth, we have this incredibly plastic brain that is able to both respond to lots of different information and cope with unexpected events in development. So, well, what about at stroke? Is there a sensitive period? Meaning, as the brain is recovering, does it require the expression of a genetic program in response to injury? Remember I showed you the slide from Tom Carmichael of the gene expression going up and down, and that it actually requires the expression of a genetic program in order to recover. And to a certain extent, the pattern of gene expression does resemble the same pattern of gene expression that we see during development. Does it depend on experience and environment? And most of the people in this room have placed a bet that on their career that they can affect stroke recovery by experience and environment. So you have a lot of your energy, your life energy, riding on that bullet. Does it stabilize after a while, meaning the plasticity begins to go away? And does it have features of a sensitive period, a window of opportunity to make an intervention that once it passes, well, you can still make some changes, but you miss the time that you were best able to make a change in the recovery pattern. And therefore, if you don't use it, it's potentially a lost opportunity to affect your patient's outcome. All right. So we saw virtuoso science yesterday. Here's another example from Dale Corbett's lab. This is now an old study. And this was a study looking at the response in rodents to focal motor training, or to motor training, forelimb training. And many of you probably know this study. The rats were lesioned using a focal ischemia model. And then they were randomized to receive motor training at different time points after their injury. And the motor training was similar to what you saw yesterday. The task is for the animal to reach out and grab what looks to me like an M&M, some chocolate. I don't know if that's what it was. And what it showed is over here that basically this is the group of animals that had no lesion at all. So they were just in social housing. This was the group in the black triangles this is the control group up here. The group with the black triangles are the group that were lesioned and received only social housing and no rehabilitation training. And so they're the other control group. And then the animals are randomized to get motor training beginning at 5 days after stroke, 14 days after stroke, or 30 days after injury. I shouldn't say stroke. I should say injury. And what it shows, basically, is the animals that receive motor training beginning at 30 days after injury were indistinguishable from the animals that received no motor training. So the ability of those rodents to respond to motor training was not present. The rodents that received training at beginning 5 days after injury or 14 days after injury had a substantial recovery, with the 5 day time point probably being a little bit better than the 14 day time point. Okay, so this kind of work has been done in other labs. The speakers yesterday hinted at other experiments like this, but using this one as our model. This raises important questions for clinicians about how they treat their patients and when to treat their patients. And for somebody like me who's interested in taking a scientific finding and translating it into a meaningful change in patient treatment, it represents maybe, hopefully not a dead end, and hopefully an opportunity to improve recovery. So why is this important? Well, first of all, it's a well-done study. This is a good lab. It was randomized. The conditions were carefully controlled. This is the study that we're going to try and translate in a few minutes. It was a clean population, as I'll show you. The lesions were systematically applied and were pretty consistent across animals. And they were able to look at some neurobiological aspects of the experiment. It did show timing effects, best response beginning day 5. Still a good response at day 14, but not as good. No response to motor training at day 30. And suggests the existence of a sensitive period after stroke, at least in this rodent stroke model. It's been replicated, and for people like me, it's a provocative finding with potential clinical relevance. Okay, that's all good. Life is never completely straightforward. These are another set of experiments done by Tim Schallert, who you heard a little bit about yesterday. He did an experiment where he did, his lab, actually it was Lee Hum, did an experiment where they also lesioned rodents, and they were trying to model constraint-induced movement therapy. So they took the rodents, they lesioned them, and they put them into a cast so they could not use their unaffected forelimb, their less affected forelimb. So forcing them to use their affected forelimb. Okay? If they did that early, meaning before the animal woke up from the anesthesia, put the animal back in the cage, the animal had the largest stroke lesion. Okay, the lesion was actually larger than the control animals who were not casted, suggesting that forcing the animals to use their affected forelimb immediately after injury actually increased the size of the stroke. Remember, we'd rather have the stroke smaller than larger, and also worsen the motor outcome in this experiment. So the other experiments, it's been pretty clear that the lesion size increases, less clear that how badly motor outcome is affected. It's also been found in TBI models. Now, if you casted the animals later at 15 days, you did not see this effect. And you can block it with an NMDA antagonist and suggesting that there's an excitotoxic mechanism to this. So what you have, if you want to replicate that first animal study that I showed you, the Biernaski study, saying that in rodents, early is good, 5 days is good. Late is not good. If you wait till 30 days, at least in rodents, you can't get a motor training effect. So it suggests the presence of a sensitive period. There's other data suggesting that too much too early is bad, that you can actually enlarge the stroke lesion. Now, the question people always ask is, well, 5 days in a rat life, how does that map to humans? How does this map to my patients? I have no idea. I don't know. I mean, people use these ratios. Well, a rat lives 2 years, a human lives 70 years, 35 to 1. You can take that as you wish. And the relevance to humans is uncertain. So these are the kind of constraining parameters we have if you want to ask the timing question. All right. So how would we go about detecting a sensitive period in patients as opposed to rodents? So what we want to do is translate that experiment of Biernaski et al. From Dale's lab into the human setting. And as you can see, in the United States, we talk about how in Congress to pass a bill requires the making of a lot of sausage, meaning that a lot of things are mixed in that maybe are not so attractive. So I will show you the sausage that we made. But the goal here is what Günter Grass said, which is translation is that which transforms everything so that nothing changes. So how true can we be to the details of that Biernaski experiment, as well as the goals of that experiment within the clinical realities that we face? So thinking about this, the first thing we think we know, is that, and a lot of these data here on this slide come from stroke units in Scandinavia as well as the UK. These are old experiments from the 90s comparing the effects or the outcomes of patients with stroke who were randomized to either a general medical unit or a specialty stroke unit. And those specialty stroke units were a little different than what's here in Oslo, apparently, and certainly what's different in the U.S., in that the patients receive rehabilitation on the same unit that they that their acute stroke was treated. In the States, it's two separate hospitals, and the two don't overlap. The thing I want you to take away from this, well, first of all, the good news for people like us is that the patients who went to the specialty units did better, and that those treatment effects persisted for years afterwards. The second thing is the divergence between the patients that went to the specialty units and went to the general units took place at roughly a month after stroke onset. Okay? Up until, certainly till 2 weeks or so, or up to 4 weeks even, the two groups were the same. But at that point, they diverged. So whatever the treatment effect is, the black box that is specialized stroke care, at least in the 90s, at least in Northern Europe, was present and effective within about a month after stroke onset. The second thing we know is that I'm not a therapist, and I personally don't see that much difference between different training paradigms. I think they're all, my own opinion is they're all pretty equivalent in the clinical setting. And that's not always a popular opinion. This is an older now meta-analysis from 2009 looking at all these different treatments for upper extremity motor restoration and showing that basically not only are they not very different, but they're also not very effective. Now, I would guess that Gert, who teaches meta-analysis, is going to give you the updated versions. We didn't talk, but I'm going to guess he's going to do that. But I'm not sure he's going to change my mind. We'll see. The thing I want you to remember is all clinical trials and all meta-analyses are estimates. Okay, they're estimates of reality. They are not a definitive determination of reality. And the smaller the sample size, the worse the estimate, and I'll show you that in a second. And when you look at the sample sizes here, they're tiny by clinical trial standards. So hypertension drugs enroll tens of thousands of patients. Okay, and that's what it takes to actually get a treatment effect. Here, there are hardly any trials that enroll tens of dozens of patients. So these sample sizes are very small, and I view this as sort of an early estimate of the effectiveness of different motor paradigms. Depending on which one you like, bilateral training, constraint, DMG biofeedback, stimulation, high-intensity therapy, mental practice, well, again, when you go over here and you look at the forest plot, you don't look all that different. And I want to remind you also that small samples, again, I want to pound this point home because I see this a lot in rehabilitation. These meta-analyses that use small sample studies are very unreliable. So this is a study in osteoarthritis treatment, where there have been trials enrolling dozens of patients asking in small trials, so 95 small trials with fewer than 100 patients per arm compared to 58 large trials. What you see is that the small trials consistently overestimate the eventual effect size that is seen in the large trials, the better estimate of reality. Okay, so when you see a study saying this treatment is wonderful and I enrolled 10 subjects in each group, you want to remember this slide. And you might even want to remember this slide where they actually looked at many different treatments. This is a meta-analysis of meta-analyses, asking how good at meta-analyses of small trials at predicting the outcomes of large trials. And so if you look at, and they look at it by group, so a trial that perfectly predicted the outcome of a large trial, this point here would be at 1. So the odds ratio, this is a ratio of odds ratio is what's being graphed here. A perfect trial would predict the exact same odds ratio as a large definitive trial would. And you can, and they define that arbitrarily as a trial enrolling 1,000 subjects per group. It's orders of magnitude different from what we see in rehabilitation trials. So the largest trials, those with 500 to 999 subjects per group, overestimated the effect size by about 20%. That was found in the larger, more definitive trial. When you go to the other end of the spectrum down here with trials that enroll fewer than 50 subjects per group, they overestimated by about 50% with a confidence interval up to like 2/3. So the point of all of this is read those small trials, including mine, but view them very carefully. And particularly for the smaller studies, look very carefully at the study design. How do they adjust for covariates, confounds, etc., and how do they select their subjects? The smaller the study, the more careful you have to be in interpreting it, particularly. And in these small samples, like we tend to use in rehabilitation, it becomes particularly important about the methodology. So the largest trial I can think of, and correct me if I'm wrong, was Pam Duncan's LEAPS trial, which enrolled about 200 per subject. There's a bigger trial?
Avert.
Okay, it was 800. Was 400 per group. I'm sorry, how many? 2,000. So that is the first trial they got to their. I forgot about Avert. How could I forget? I have a slide about Avert. The first trial that I know of in rehabilitation that met this criteria of 1,000 patients. Okay, all the rest of them are much smaller. Okay, so this issue of too much too soon, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it because we have one trial during inpatient care in the first 24 hours. This is the AVERT trial where patients were randomized to receive either mobilization or very intensive mobilization. in the first 24 hours after stroke onset. And what they found was a remarkably noticeable effect on disability and mortality at 3 months, and in the wrong direction. So the patients that got more intensive treatment actually did worse. People ask me all the time about the Vector study, which we did in St. Louis back in the early 2000s. There we randomized inpatient rehab patients an average of 9 days after stroke onset to receive either 2 hours of shaping and plus 6 hours of constraint, or 3 hours of shaping plus constraint all day while awake, or a modified usual and customary care that was also 2 hours of dose match. And what we found was that 2 hours of constraint and 2 hours of conventional care had no difference. They were the same in terms of the outcome, the motor outcome at 90 days, but that the high-intensity group did not recover as well. So the higher intensity treatment in this sample of patients with this treatment at this center at this time actually led to a worse motor outcome at 90 days. They recovered less well. They recovered, but they recovered less well. And I'm sorry? So the high intensity was 3 hours a day, one-on-one with an occupational therapist for 10 days, receiving shaping treatment, plus wearing the constraint during waking hours, except when the patient was in the bathroom.
So the low dose is 2 hours.
2 hours of shaping and wearing the constraint, 6 hours. I'm sorry?
Not a big difference.
Not a big difference in AVERT either. So when you actually look at the minutes of training, not a big difference. Okay? Now, this has not been universally replicated. So this study was published in 2009. The Vectors trial. I didn't make a big deal of it because this is an estimate of reality with a small sample size. I started paying more. I mean, I was aware of it. And I wanted to make sure everybody was aware of it, but I began to pay more attention to it after the AVERT trial, suggesting that what we see in rodents may actually see in humans as well. Okay. The second trial I want to tell you about is another one I was involved in. This is the ICARE trial. Carolee Winstein, Steve Wolf, and I led this trial. It was a 7-site trial in the United States. We looked at the outpatient epic, so a different column in that table I showed you before. And so what the goal here was to try and capture what happens in outpatient therapy as soon as the patient is discharged from the hospital. So there were two questions. During that period of time, was an occupational therapy treatment using best practices of motor learning, all the things that we teach the physical and occupational therapy students to do, things like consolidation and mass practice and all those things, was it better than what licensed therapists deliver in the community, which is, at least in the U.S., a much more unstructured thing tailored to the need, what the therapist perceives to be the needs of the patient. So there's a therapy content question. The second question, I already told you that my own opinion is the motor training paradigms don't really matter that much in the clinical. So far, we haven't been able to show that motor training paradigms matter that much in the clinical setting. The second aim was one that was much more interesting to me, is does a higher dose of therapy lead to a better outcome? So if we gave the patient more hours of treatment, of usual and customary treatment, but matched the amount of therapy they got with this treatment, the number of hours they got with that treatment, would the patients have a better outcome? So there were 3 study arms to this. There was the ASAP, the Accelerated Skill Acquisition Program. You can go and read about it in the paper, but basically this was a structured best practices motor training. Therapists were very carefully trained to deliver this in a consistent way. They were monitored to ensure that treatment fidelity was present. It used aspects of task-specific training, mass practice, self-efficacy, and problem-solving. Patients received 30 hours of this. The second arm of the study that they could have been randomized to was a dose equivalent usual and customary care. So the patients went out into the community, got their therapy from their therapist, and the study paid to make sure that they got at least that they got 30 hours of therapy. Okay, so not best practices, just whatever the therapist thinks they should get, but getting 30 hours, matching for the amount of the treatment. And then the third was usual and customary care. So in the U.S., this means whatever the patient decides they'll go to the therapist for, the therapist wants to give them, the physician writes the prescription for, the insurance company will pay for, and the family member will drive them to the therapy site to get their therapy. So a true observational control. We randomized people 14 to 106 days after onset. We randomized 360, so 120 per group. The mean time from stroke onset to randomization was 46 days, and we had 84% follow-up at 12 months. So these patients were essentially pure motor stroke patients. They could only have very limited amounts of language impairment, neglect, sensory impairment. They had to have some finger extension. Again, you can read the exact details in the paper, but it was basically a pure motor group. So what did we find? We found out it didn't matter which arm of the study they were randomized to. The outcome was the same at 1 year. It didn't matter whether they got the best practices treatment. It didn't matter whether they got the high-dose usual and customary care or the true usual and customary care. At 1 year, the outcome in these measures that I'm showing you here were the Wolf motor function time score, the log transformed version. So they started out more impaired or slower, and then they got faster, but you can see that the three groups had no difference. The untransformed Wolf time score, and in this case, the self-reported assist, the stroke impact scale, hand function scale, no difference. So for this, Carolee was sad because the best practices training had no benefit over the usual customary care training. And I was sad because there was no dose effect. So, and the dose difference between the usual and customary care and the high-intensity usual and customary care, the high-intensity group got 27 hours, the observation only usual and customary care got 13 hours. So in the outpatient phase of stroke care, doubling the amount of treatment did not change the outcome. Yes?
Do you think it was a bit too late, 46 days, as the name
said? I don't know. You know, I think we're filling in the table. All right. So we have another manuscript in preparation which says that the patients like the ASAP treatment, the best practices treatment better. And that paper will be going to Dr. Dudo's journal probably in the next few weeks. And I'm sure he's going to accept it. Not that I'm lobbying Dr. Nudo. They actually preferred it. They reported higher self-reported motor and disability scores at 1 year on measures other than the stroke impact scale. And we also looked at their confidence in their ability to use their arm, and they reported that was higher than this best practices group. Okay. So, moving along to a third study. Why is this? I accidentally turned this off. Okay, well, I'll just. Oh, I lost it. Okay, a third study published just in the last month or two. This was a study that I participated. Oh, no. This is actually looking at the lesions in the cohort from iCare. So one of the things we did in this, people like me used this population of pure motor stroke patients to study motor training paradigms. And we wanted to understand what the lesions look like in these patients and how they resemble or differ from the rodent models. So we had clinical imaging. This is not experimental imaging where we could control the imaging sequences and timing and so forth. We had clinical imaging on almost 300 of the 360 patients, and we asked how many of them look like the rodent models that you heard about yesterday. And what we did was we looked at the lesion location. This is a very, because we did not have experimental imaging where we could control, where we could have the data, all we had were the images. We used this very old technique from the DeMasios from back in the 80s. And here, by the way, is the stroke. And it is not a coincidence that it's a deep subcortical stroke. What we found was that about half the patients, 58%, had a right hemisphere stroke. 87% were ischemic. The median infarct volume was actually quite small. It's 1.8 mils, milliliters, which is actually a fairly small stroke. If you look at an unselected stroke population, well, there's a bunch of series out there, but the typical size of ischemic strokes in the other series are between 9 and 35 milliliters, so a much smaller lesion. The hemorrhages, there were 13% were hemorrhages, they were also much smaller than unselected series. 15% had old stroke lesions, which they may or may not. There are actually very few people. We allowed people who had a prior stroke who had recovered fully to enter this trial. There were very few of those, not enough to analyze. And then 20% of them had moderate or severe leukoareas, for changes associated with age and poor cardiovascular risk factor control. So the patients are very different from the unselected stroke population, and they're also different from the animal models. So if we look at the ischemic strokes, of which there were 258, looking at patients who have pure cortical lesions, well, there was only one of them in this trial out of the 306, out of the 300 that we looked at. If we looked at a total middle cerebral artery occlusion model, there was only one of those, and that was stretching. It was actually only about half the middle cerebral artery volume. There were 16, there were 40 patients that had a stroke that looked like close enough to a cortical photocoagulation or endothelium 1 model, which is what we heard mostly about yesterday. You know, cortical gray plus superficial white matter involvement. And so forth. So the message here is that if lesions matter in terms of determining outcome in response to rehabilitation treatment, if you're interested in pure motor stroke in your patients, we're studying different kinds of lesions. Okay. The other study I promised you was Catherine Lang's study. Here we tried to replicate the rodent studies that you saw in chronic stroke patients. This is a smaller study. The question was, what amount of motor training in chronic stroke, meaning greater than 6 months, produces the greatest motor improvements? So it's a dose response study. It's a phase 2 trial. 85 subjects were randomized. They were randomized to get either 3,200 repetitions of training, 6,400, 9,600, or as much as they could stand until they plateaued, an individualized maximum. Okay? They received this training in 1 hour sessions 4 times a week for 8 weeks. Again, trying to replicate the sort of daily training that we see in the rodent models. We used a progressive task-specific upper extremity training program. That we used the COPM to identify goals for the patient, and the action research arm test was the primary outcome. So the patients received 32 sessions. The individualized maximum received an average of 36 sessions. One patient received 58 sessions. About 18 of the age group completed the treatments. They received in the lower intensity group 13.6 hours, medium 20 hours, higher 26, and in the highest group 33 hours of motor training. So what did we find? Nothing. Nothing. Or almost nothing. So the changes on the action research arm test score were less than a point per week in all the groups. This now, because the column here in the table, that's the chronic group. All right? There was no dose-response relationship, which would have been nice to have seen. And there was no meaningful change in upper extremity use measured by self-report and
accelerometer. So in chronic hemiparesis, in this experiment, motor training had no effect. All right. So let's go ahead and skip this. Going back to this study quickly, we are engaged in the critical periods after stroke study, translating that to an ASCII study. Specifically, is there a period of time when patients are particularly responsive to motor training? In the Bernaski study, days 5 and 14 were the most interesting, right? I'm agnostic about motor training paradigms. What we ended up using was the vector shaping paradigm, tweaked a little bit. And I was also agnostic about the dose. We are not trying to optimize the dose of training. We're simply trying to find a signal that, gee, if you give the patients an extra bolus of training at a certain time point after stroke, you will see a better response. Okay? You have to translate the subjects, the lesions, the time points, and the training, among other things. You have to take into account the real world, which means that patients have lots of complications during stroke rehab. They are not sitting there all rested and healthy waiting for their motor training session. They're sick, they're infected, they're old, they weren't in such good physical condition beforehand. There's psychosocial stresses, there's health system barriers. And the worry that I have is that a biological critical period could be obscured by a psychosocial critical period, that either the patient or the family is unable to really engage in the treatment, in the training, or that the system does not allow the flexibility to really test this hypothesis. So the subjects in the original rodent study were Sprague Dolly male rats. They were young and healthy. They had a specific size. They had standardized housing and standardized sleep-wake cycle. I'm sure the rehab hospitals in Norway are much more organized than ones in the U.S. These patients that we are selecting, 21 days or older, ischemic or hemorrhagic stroke less than a month. Motor impairment criteria that look very similar to what we use in vectors do not require finger extension. Much harder to find a few days after stroke. And no concurrent significant neurologic disorders. Remember, the lesions used in MCA vasospasm model, they threw out the rodents that didn't respond the way they wanted. I think this is actually really important because in rodent models you can do this. And this is a strength of the rodent models, not a weakness. You can really get at the basic principles, which we can't do in the clinical setting. Anybody with a full MCA distribution, they're probably not going to qualify for this study because they're going to have no voluntary motor control. We accepted ischemic infarct anywhere, just as we did with eye care and with the Catherine Lang study, with the vector study, and also patients with hemorrhage. In the time points, the rodents were assessed for inclusion at days 3 and 4 after the lesioning. They were randomized at that point to do training at day 5, day 14, day 30, and they were assessed based on days from treatment initiation. In our hospital, everybody in the United States says, oh, our patients stay only for 3 or 4 days in the acute hospital, and then they go to rehab. And the rehab hospitals say, oh, we take all our patients within 3 or 4 days of onset. But when you actually look at the data, it's about 11 days after stroke onset in the U.S. that the average rehabilitation hospital accepts the stroke patients. So the rehab subpopulation stays in the acute hospital much longer. At day 5 time point, we cannot accomplish in our hospital. What we basically did was we said that we would take patients out to 28 days. We've been restricting randomization to those who can be randomized within 21 days of stroke onset, trying to accomplish that 14-day time point. And we're doing an okay job. Our average time to randomization is about 15 days after stroke onset. There is a group that gets their treatment immediately after stroke at the 60 to 90-day time point, just like in eye care, and at the 6-month time point, just like the Catherine Lang study. And we get time points, baseline pre-treatment and post-treatment, 6 months and 1 year. Think about the treatment. The treatment is the reaching for food pellets, in this case, M&Ms. The food is, their feeding is restricted. They're not starved, but their feeding is restricted to, they get this training before meals. The control was no treatment, and they received 6 hours a day for 40 days.
We would have loved to do that study. We have to feed our patients, or the IRB just hates it. M&Ms are bad for you, particularly if you're a diabetic who had a stroke. Our IRB and I would not want to be in a study or allow a study where there was no treatment, although I think that study is coming. Rather than underfeeding the patients and giving them chocolate, we use self-selected tasks for shaping, again, to increase motivation. We chose 20 hours of therapy, okay, much lower than the rodents, partly for practicality, partly because 20 hours, as we pointed out with the vector study, was enough to change the outcome. And so what was the smallest dose that we thought would be likely to change the outcome? And we chose 20 hours based on the vector data. And again, we used a modified version of the vector protocol. To finish up, this is a phase 2 single center study, 64 subjects, 4 groups, 16 subjects per group, a very rough estimate of reality. We've now randomized 49. We randomize 1.7 a month. No matter how hard we work, it's always 1.7 a month. We use an adaptive randomization to balance for 6 key features. We've effectively combined those day 5 and 14 time points. We have no choice. We could try and move this training into the hospital, as it was done with the AVERT study, and that would probably be the next step if this shows no signal. This is done in addition to usual and customary care therapy. Patients get everything they would normally get. This is on top of their usual and customary care treatment. And so this is the design. The patient has a stroke onset. They're assessed and randomized as early as possible. Right now, an average of 15 or 16 days. They're randomized to be either into the early group to get their study-related treatment immediately, or at 2 to 3 months, or at 6 to 7 months, or at 1 year. The control group gets no treatment out to the primary time point of 1 year. Then we offer them treatment if they want it. Interestingly, only about half of them want it. The other half say, it's not worth the trouble. So the message here is these animal studies lead the way to how we're going to improve treatments. Translating them, however, is complicated. And if you want a more detailed discussion of this, here's a citation for you. It forces you to make choices about what is essential and what can be modified, what must be modified. And again, I don't want to make too much of the study. It's an interesting phase 2 trial, interesting to me. I hope it becomes a phase 3 trial. Like many clinical trials, it takes a village and 4 universities and an entire metropolitan area to pull this off. And I thank you very much.
Thank you very much for this wonderful speech. And you are a movement scientist and a professor in human rehabilitation at a university in Amsterdam that is called EU University, and I founded that stands for Vrije Universiteit.
That's right, but it's not free, I can guarantee you. Right. Thank you for the introduction, and thanks for this very wonderful conference allowing me to give the talk of this quality. And I'd like to talk about understanding motor recovery early after stroke, some lessons from the explicit stroke program. Explicit stands for, it's an acronym explaining plasticity after stroke. It took us 8 years to conduct this trial, and I think there are some lessons from this. What I'd like to discuss for this hour is what the evidence of physical therapy post-stroke and how should we design recovery trials. And the key question in this, can we influence the pattern of spontaneous neurological recovery after stroke by motor learning, and what's the evidence? And what is the effect changing in motor performance? We don't know what patients exactly learn, and that's a thing that's neglected in the literature. One of my PhDs did an awful job, and she reviewed the literature about what's the evidence, and already emphasized there's a pooled meta-analysis and effect sizes, and she found 53 different interventions, 467 different trials. And we can say that the effect sizes in these trials are small to moderate, explaining about 5 to 50% of the variance of outcome. There's no evidence. Despite the enhanced plasticity early protocol, there's a positive interaction with time when you compare within the first 3 hours, 3 months and beyond the 3 months, not higher effect sizes. However, also emphasizing and relating to Alexander's talk, many trials are poor designed, no primary measurements of outcome, and a lot of problems in these trials. And comparing this systematic review of our guidelines 10 years ago, you will see that the methodological quality is improving. That's the good message. There's no clearness about the intervention protocols actually applied. You like to replicate it, but it's not possible. You don't know exactly what's done. And there are almost no trials in the implementation in which patients are stratified. And I will emphasize this, we are talking about precision medicine, it's also selection, and the approach selection for the approach type of therapy. And almost all trials do not start at fixed moments. They start arbitrary moments post in the time window of spontaneous neurological recovery, and the question is, what's the impact of that? And there is no consensus on the use outcomes in stroke recovery trials, making studies incomparable. And the final one is maybe the crucial one, and most trials do not have strong biological hypotheses that may drive motor learning. And that's particularly the case nowadays with new medical devices and so on. It's all to do with a good hypothesis behind the medical device. I have another talk, it's going about robots versus new gadgets. And these gadgets need a good hypothesis behind it. So that makes that the evidence that we have is quite unstable. However, there's also a lot of studies in which we have sufficient trials and are quite stable with sufficient power. However, after 4 years, about 50% of your guidelines, you can throw it in the garbage can. Because there's a shift, new trials coming up, shifting the evidence to the left or to the right. Mm. But on the positive side, I'm convinced, and looking to these 467 trials, you may say that intensity and task in the context specificity are the main drivers for understanding effective care. It's fairly specific, it doesn't generalize. And we know that training should be meaningful, challenging, target on a specific goal, feasible, not too easy, not too difficult, sufficient dose or intensity, and preferably progressive in time. I'd like to go back to when I was starting in the 90s with our trial, in which we applied this high-dose therapy, exercise therapy, and we randomized patients with a fairly severe ischemic stroke, military artery stroke, first ever stroke, into three groups. A lower limb group that received every day, 3/4 a day, 5 times a week, 20 weeks long, additionally lower limb training. A blue group that received the same amount for the upper limb, in just 50 minutes lower limb training. And we had a third group that we immobilized. And this reminds me yesterday with the casting, what Randy was telling about. We prevented these patients from an active motor learning process, 3/4 a day. So there's a large contrast, and what you can see, there's a speeding up of the pattern of functional recovery. In fact, we don't know what patients exactly learn, but this difference of 4 points is huge. I was surprised because I was able to do this, because at that time we had different approaches, and the Afolto therapy is saying, okay, you should prevent spasticity. So I had this splint, giving placebo-like therapy, knowing that these patients have an active motor learning process. And despite this immobilization, it is less compared with the low extremity group. But at the end, there's still a catch-up after releasing after 20 weeks, and patients are quickly recovering to the level that is not significantly different from the low extremity group or the upper limb group. Also emphasizing there's a mechanism behind this. We call it spontaneous neurological recovery, and we don't understand what's really happening. But time alone is helping patients. And that's the thing to remember. Only believe well-conducted, randomized clinical trials. Because even putting two fingers in your nose or core therapy, it works. And the patient is improved. I was also surprised to see that the upper limb group didn't differ significantly despite almost 100 hours additional therapy compared to the low extremity. The question is why? And it has much to do with the Bartel index. Bartel index doesn't measure upper limb function, but rather how patients are learning to compensate. And doing it more specifically on the exercise afterwards, you will find significant differences in favor of this task-specific training. However, one birth doesn't make a sum. Doing an accumulated meta-analysis, starting with the study with the lowest treatment contrast and ending up with the study with the highest treatment contrast, you will find that higher doses benefits patients. And this is quite similar to what was found also by Catherine Lang and Lewis, finding a moderate, small moderate effect size. And again, a positive relationship between the intensity that's applied and the effect size that's found. But no interaction effects with the timing person, unfortunately. So the question now is, how to augment exercise training with less staff? And that's the challenge, I think, for the next decade. Because we don't have the staff to apply 100 hours therapy. And that might be skilled nursing. Or what we're doing, for example, caregiver-mediated exercises. Training caregivers who is willing to support or family members in the stroke unit or in the medical or in the rehab ward, and as trainers, as coaches, as therapists. And maybe robotics, but it's not clear if robotics are fairly effective. At least we can apply higher doses. I will come back to that. And maybe circuit loss training, in which you can include more patients simultaneously, having two physical therapists or an assistant physical therapist, and training in workstations with patients together. So we have to think about the augmentation of intensity of therapy by smart solutions. And the other one is evidence-based, and that's the best effective therapy that you can apply for the upper limb, that's constraint reduced movement therapy. There are different versions. There's only one original version, the EXCITE study. In which 6 hours is applied. We have the modified versions, 1 hour or 2 hours additional therapy. And we have the force use therapy in which we only apply the padded mitt to prevent the use of the non-traumatic arm. And we know that's effective. In fact, we don't need more trials in this field because the evidence is so overwhelming that it's effective for the Wolf motor function test or for the action search arm test, for the self-reported amount of arm use, and also for the quality of arm use as shown in this slide. But strikingly, the effects on impairment level are not that high. So it's not really explaining why the large effect sizes on capacity level is found with the prosthetic leg. And also the good message is, at follow-up, it still remains the positive effects of modified versions of constitutive movement therapy. But also emphasizing that, for example, force use, 6 trials in this field, as shown in this slide, doesn't have positive effects. So constraining is not the issue in this constraint-induced movement therapy. It's the shaping and the task-specific practice that make the difference, not the restriction of the prosthetic arm. However, it's also selection by the settlers. It's selecting patients with some thick extension and some wrist extension, suggesting that there should be some intactness of this worthless spinal plexus. And that's the same what also is forecast by this SAFE model, shoulder abduction finger extension model. You have, in fact, two groups. It's a patient with a favorable prognosis with finger extension and some shoulder abduction. And it's already predictable within 72 hours after stroke. So it's largely defined. There's an unfavorable prognostic group without this. But it's also shown that the negative predictive value is a little bit lower. I'm not so fairly sure that none of these patients will regain dexterity, in other words. But when time is progressing, I'm getting more sure that this patient will fail or not fail on regaining dexterity. I will come back to this important issue. So, can we pull all these patients together in making a randomized clinical trial? Is this a wise decision? Patients with finger extension and no finger extension. And we can do this now from the explicit trial because we measure these patients at every week and we have with finger extension and without finger extension. And the answer is no, in fact not. When you put all these patients together, you will need numbers. 400 patients almost, but when you select only patients, for example, with finger extension, the numbers that's needed for doing a randomized clinical trial is much lower. And when I select patients without finger extension, it's clear it's increasing by time. So if I'm selecting patients within 12 weeks and without finger extension, then you need higher samples. But making stratification in your trial is a fairly wise decision. If I Kugelmeier R-scores as the primary measurement of outcome. And the same is true for the extracellular samples, of course. So I think stratified trials is lacking. And we have to think much better about the prognosis of these patients when doing these trials. Also about the timing. The timing is a big issue. Most trials that we observe in the literature are trials that are starting at arbitrary moments per stroke. 3 weeks, because then there's a bed in our rehab ward and the patient is randomized, or within 5 days or 10 days post-stroke. Anyway, at arbitrary times. And that makes that if I'm recruiting these patients at arbitrary times, much more patients I need. The best way is to recruit them at a fixed moment post-stroke, within the first week. And this is the case for the Kugelmeier R-score or the extracellular samples, just as an example. Because there are a lot of problems in these trials that we have in stroke rehabilitation, we organized, and in fact, Julie Bennett organized a group, a stroke recovery group, in to improve stroke recovery trials and also be better in line with the preclinical researchers, the biomarker group, the intervention group, we organize the outcome group. And having better consensus, this is an old slide already shown by Alexander. Having this not at arbitrary times, but at fixed times, the measurements that we recommend. And it's also important to be clear what is subacute phase, what is acute phase. And the funny thing is, in Philadelphia, everybody in our group did understand different time frames about acute, subacute, or whatever. I think we have to be fairly clear about the definitions about what subacute is. Therefore, there's also a definition paper coming up in which we have some consensus about these time frames. At least the recommendation is to do it at fixed times. An interesting question now is, who are the exceptions in this? How sure? The negative predictive value is much lower. Well, there's something exception. Okay, no worries, it will come good. Patients will have some dexterity. And I'm interested now in your dose with the partial recovery first of all, that suddenly show differences and suddenly show figure extension there. And this is just a longitudinal study again with repeated measurements in time from the explicit 91 stroke patients and looking to those that had some return with an initial no finger extension, suddenly return of this finger extension. And it's clear it's happening mainly in the first weeks after stroke. And these are the true negatives. No return, no finger extension, no dexterity at the end. And the interesting thing is it's happening in a critical time window of about 8 weeks. There's one exception at the end, but it's happening within the first 3 months. And what you have to do is, in fact, observing these patients weekly or daily, maybe, and just to evaluate is there some voluntary finger extension or not. And then after 12 weeks, you are pretty sure, okay, this is a real poor prognosis. And the patients who are making the exceptions of this prediction rule are those patients that have no visual spatial neglect, no somatosensory deficits, so pure motor hemiplegias, making exceptions, high probability for regaining some dexterity, and a low probability who has a multimodal deficit, proprioceptive loss, and so on as well. So what we can now conclude by some fact that upper limb recovery is highly predictable, and there's a critical time window, 8 weeks, 10 weeks, in which you need to observe these patients daily, weekly, whatever, and there's a need for weekly screening for these patients. And for that, together with Stephen Gould and Mark Bailey and Michelle McDonald, we developed a prognostic algorithm for upper limb function, knowing that finger extension requires different evidence-based practice than if you don't have it. So we have a lot of different boxes with evidence-based practice in this, that you can do in groups or not in groups. And this is quite complicated, but at least it shows that this finger extension should be monitored weekly in this study when patients are progressing. And this is much too difficult, of course. And therefore, we made an app for this, and in this app, the algorithm is included, and if you have finger extension, you are coming to a different type of box, and you can download it on this website. Another thing is spontaneous neurological recovery, and that might be also for animal studies, in my opinion, is an important but still neglected feature of the clinical course of patients with stroke. What do we know about spontaneous neurological recovery? Is it predictable? Do all patients follow the same amount of spontaneous neurological recovery, acknowledging that 80% of that improvement is introduced by progress of time alone? And the answer is no. Most patients on this Spiegelmeier follow a straight line, highly predictable. And the improvement in the Spiegelmeier within 72 hours observed is about 70 to 80% times the maximum available score. 66 points is the maximum score, minus the initial score within 72 hours, and you will have a straight line. So on top of this are patients that started very poorly without anything on the Spiegelmeier, but showing excellent recovery at the end. But at the same time, we also found patients with almost no change in the spontaneous neurological recovery. These patients expected 44 points change, but actually observed 7 points change. So they don't have spontaneous neurological recovery. But that's something. And to make it more clear, this is just a sample of these patients with complete extension. All patients, again, all patients show spontaneous neurological recovery of about this 70% prediction rule when following it. There's no exception. However, without kidney extension, and a fraction of these patients show spontaneous neurological recovery. But also, out of the 56, didn't show any spontaneous neurological recovery at all. So these are flat, no changes in time, and remaining almost at the same level. Let's go to another modality, neglect. You may think, okay, maybe this is something from motor function, but it isn't the case. This is visual spatial neglect, left cancellation task, 20 hours on the right side, 20 hours on the left side, patient has to stretch this. And you may ask, is this, this is spontaneous neurological recovery for the main part? Is this predictable? Yes, the same curve. 70 to 80%, we found the 80% rule, is 20 points minus the letter cancellation task measured within the first week or 72 hours. And you will have a good, good estimate of the amount of change that you may expect on neglect. And there are, again, outliers, non-fitters in this prediction rule. And we expect the human health point, but actually observe 3 points. So no changes at all. And now, the interesting part. When you're looking to these patients, 90 patients in the same hemisphere, non-dominant hemisphere, showing this massive infarctions, the patients that are not fitting in the prediction rule for motor recovery are the same that are also not recovering on neglect. So, it's not only to do with this intactness of corticospinal tract system and intactness of tail rest or whatever. There's a common system behind this that's the same, okay, you are fitter and you are not fitter in the spontaneous neurological recovery. And this has a huge impact. I think this will be a game changer also for designing trials. This will be a little bit boring now, because for the lower limb, okay, there's more standard deviation because the Fukumaya on the lower limb is a little bit less precise. There's a 60% recovery rule within 72 hours, 34 points maximum, minus initial score, and there are outliers in this. And again, the same patients are not recovering on the lower limb, are also not recovering on the upper limb. So, a common system that defines figures from non-figures. Okay, so what we may conclude, that spontaneous motor recovery of the upper parietal limb is proportional fixed in most patients with moderate and neurological deficits, that spontaneous recovery in visual spatial neglect is proportional fixed, and this is something that is found by John Krakauer in 2010 already, that patients also show spontaneous recovery in dysphagia on this Western facial test battery, also almost 70% of the spontaneous recovery rule. And what we may say now, there's evidence that patients who are not following the expected amount of spontaneous recovery for one modality are also failing for the other neurological modalities. And that brings me to the question, should we stratify randomized clinical trials in the future on recovers and non-recovers on spontaneous neurological recovery, because it will have a huge impact. And so what I'm now saying is finger extension, no finger extension, but 25 of these finger extensions are becoming fitters, showing spontaneous neurological recovery, and there are expectations on that fitters. And doing this in the sample size calculation, it's clear it doesn't matter when I'm having non-fitters in my trial in the first 3 months, because they don't show spontaneous neurological recovery. In fact, I have enough with 20, 30 patients. But it's different for those with spontaneous neurological recovery. And the problem is, it's a retrospective phenomenon. We don't have the biomarker that is saying who is a fitter or non-fitter on beforehand. And that's a big service now. Maybe the Nobel Prize. And the same is this for the action transplant. So, can we influence the pattern of spontaneous neurological recovery by modeling early post-stroke? And that's the explicit trial. And I like to have it a little bit more translational. Say, okay, let's specify patients within 8 days and having some finger extension. Okay, they are going for the modified spontaneous movement therapy compared with usual care. And the other group that received EMG controlled neuromuscular stimulation. And the most tough question that you can ask me is, why did you apply EMG controlled neuromuscular stimulation for this group? I like to have this back, but in fact, I don't have an answer. And we know, don't have evidence based therapy, so I thought, okay, maybe we can get it back just by intensive stimulation, 1 hour a day, 3 weeks long, and let's look what's happening. In the meantime, we also looked at stiffness, TMS, intactness, fMRI, and also to the kinematics and to what is actually changing as a function of time. So, if you're doing this, it's a kind of election campaign, and then for 8 years to recruit all these patients from the different academic hospitals in Netherlands. Netherlands is small, so that's benefit. I don't like just pre-post intervention and randomized clinical trials. It's something odd what you're doing. But when you're doing a randomized clinical trial, you randomize these patients, closing your eyes, and after 6 months or something, you're looking again what's the difference between both groups. Yeah. I think it's much wiser not to take a photo, but make a movie. We are interested in, can we influence the pattern of function? Not the outcome, the pattern. Because that's a spontaneous neurological recovery test. And that's exactly what the aim was, and the primary measurement of outcome was the exercise afterwards. We hoped for a 6% difference favoring the constraint-induced movement therapy in the favorable stratified group. And for the EMG-controlled neuromuscular stimulation, we hoped for a 10% proportion of patients that have more decaying spontaneous return of the swing extension. And a lot of other measurements about that. But I just showed a stroke impact scale and the Fugelmeier and the Marisa index. This is the most important slide. The action search arm test we found for 3 weeks intensive modified constraint-induced movement therapy meaningful differences, 6-7 points in favor of patient's return of dexterity. And we did this for 3 weeks, but at the end, no differences was found significantly anymore, as shown in this with this p-value. And probably we should have continued with this modified constraint-induced movement. At least I'm able to show that we can influence the pattern of function of recovery. If I had a randomized clinical trial just 6 months again, I wouldn't find any differences between them. But there are differences. And also, patients like it. On the CIS domain, self-reported quality of outcome, patients like and perceive better outcomes by this constraint-induced movement therapy. Unfortunately, no differences on the Fugelmeier R score. And that's something else. Maybe that's some ceiling effects, okay, but also not on the motricity arm index, which is measuring strength. So what we found is meaningful differences on the exercise arm test, but not on motor outcomes or sensory outcomes of arm. And the other question, I will come back to that issue, is can we influence the numbers that are regaining this dexterity with this spontaneous neurological recovery in the other group that received EMG controlled neuromuscular stimulation? And these are the proportions that showed spontaneous neurological change. Unfortunately, we didn't find significant differences between both groups. And suggesting that we were not able to influence this spontaneous return, this beyond Mother Nature behind this, but we can't influence this just on the outside. So, looking back and understanding theoretic improvements, you have neural repair, and there are behavioral compensation strategies. But neural repair, vasoconstriction, is mainly driven by spontaneous neurological change itself. In my trial, and all that's why it's what we're observing. We are, don't have evidence that we are able to influence this really, but it's rather patients learn to adapt, to optimize their strategies and by substitutional, behavioral substitution, what we call compensation, whatever what you name it. So I'm coming now. What is changing in motor performance? What is really patients learning? And I think this might be interesting. What we're doing, a fairly simple thing, patients having breathing tasks, and they're doing it not like a photo once, but repeatedly in time, and looking to the kinematics, what is changing longitudinally in serial measurements in time. How do they behave? Having more precise answers of how they adapt. And this is just an example. This is a patient at 3 weeks. As soon as the patient is able to reach this task, it's clear that there's no elbow involvement. Patients are fixing the elbow in this reaching task, but moving with the trunk, as you know. Patients are compensating with the trunk. Is this wise of the patient? I think so. Because what the motor control is now doing, if bilateral control, the patient is able to reach that specific object just by proximal control, fixing the elbow. Because there's too much degrees of freedom otherwise that patients are able to need to control for. However, when patients showing spontaneous neurological change and improving as a function of time, there's more elbow involvement gradually and less trunk involvement. And when patients are really good in recovery, there's almost only, like you and me, elbow involvement and no trunk involvement anymore. Mm-hmm. So patients are adapting continuously to the difficulty of the task. Okay, this is one patient. But you can investigate this also longitudinally, like this movie. This healthy subject is a patient longitudinally measured at different time frames. And what you see is this is slower, of course, than the healthy subject. And these are the raw data, but what I'm interested in the question, what's the unique contribution of every joint in this reaching task? And of course there are errors, but these errors, random movements that is not necessary by the patient, but is clumsy and he is not able to do it in a straight line, is of course decreasing as a function of time. And the interesting part is that the degrees of freedom that is improving is happening in the same time window as spontaneous neurological recovery is happening. These are the degrees of freedom that patients are able to control for. It's happening in the first 8 weeks after stroke. Not saying that there's no improvement at all at further on, but in this time window, the quality, we are now talking about the quality, the time, the timing of the different joints in the intralimb coordination, that is really improving in the first 8 weeks. And still, patients with an excellent recovery show differences with healthy age-matched subjects. So even on the outside, say, okay, that's a perfect recovery. They have still a different performance. And an interesting thing, and therefore it's the Fukumaya, an interesting measurement of outcome. It's a little bit complicated one, but if you learn it, it's really parallels this decrease of freedom. If patients are able to do this, or a hand on the deck, or raising the arm, the synergism is reflecting the decrease of freedom that patients are able to control. And it's happening in the same time frame. So if you have tried, I shouldn't use the Fukumaya arm score beyond the first 3 months if you start a trial in a chronic race robotics. It's happening in robotics, for example, as a primary measurement factor. Another example, because it's upper limb, but it's for the lower limb to say. This is a nice study done by colleagues at Bucher, 50 patients, and showing by repeated measurements, 3, 6, 9, 12, 24 weeks, excellent recovery as a function of time. Walking speed is improving, function ablation categories, and so on. So patients are mother nature or maybe supported further by therapy improving as a function of time, mainly happening in the first 12 weeks after. What he did, he let them walk. and it's just measuring the timing of the EEG activation patterns on the prosthetic side. With, and it was an open office job because there's a lot of EEG recordings on the prosthetic side, and this is a movement cycle, a stepping cycle, where the patients are doing. And the bold lines is the activation of the erector transit, the activation during the gait cycle of the gluteus medius, and so on and so on. And you have a specific pattern when the muscles are on and off. But the interesting thing is, nothing is changing on the pelvic side. The timing, the interlink timing of activation of these EMG muscles, of these muscles, during the gait cycle is not really explaining why the patients are so much improving. So, in other words, patients are not much improving on these coordination pattern and activation of muscles during the gait cycle, but they are improving their activities by better learning to deal with this deficit that they have. So again, behavioral compensation strategies. So I think this is important because I think we need to consider these kind of expensive machines. Mm-hmm. As we know, Locomot, and they have a reference, normal movement as a reference. I think that might be reconsidered because normality for stroke patients with a deficit is not a good reference unless they act normal. But I've already shown patients don't act normal, and that's the reason why locomots in a meta-analysis don't show effects. And this is also why I'm saying to my boss in the rehab ward, to say, okay, you can spend better $500,000 not to the locomotive, but to 3-4 excellent physiotherapists. Because when you look, for example, to a Heidler study, it's the black columns, 24 sessions of physical therapist training, 1.5 hour, and the white columns are the locomotive, 1.5 hour day training, and there's a huge difference in walking speed and walking distance in favor of the physical therapist. Why? Because the physical therapists know that these compensation strategies are needed and to keep the central pressure above the non-prosthetic leg. So it's a total different strategy. And therefore, don't buy these machines. Maybe we need to wait, assist as needed. And one of the first ones is now developed in our technical university in Netherlands. And this is allowing also synergies. So you can adapt that because you like to be normal at the end, of course, but it takes these synergy, the dependent motor control into account. At least wait a couple of 5 years and having these assistance that need machines. And this is a prototype. This is a prototype. You know, the Netherlands, we are very good in soccer play. And this is a prototype of the Lopez. And this is the juggling part. And soccer players love this because they have the excellent time with these robotics and keeping the ball high, what we used to say, just on the one foot, on the other foot. And these are the scissor that they can perfect their timing. On some tricks. And this is the making of this clip. Making of the Lopez movie. So, don't believe what I'm saying there. Be critical. Anyway, behavior compensation is in the neglected part. This is just at the end. This is, of course, after 2 weeks, 26 weeks, and this is a smooth wave, this is a more hesitating wave, and I show it again. this is much more smoother, as you can see, this movement that this is. And oak, again, when you're following these pages, longitudinally in time, week 1, week 5, week 26, there's a lot of what we call a lack of smoothness or jerk. Patients, when they're doing, they are hesitating online and they are overcorrecting again, and doing this much more slowly when they have this reaching task. But it's going more ballistic when patients are improving as a function. And the interesting thing is, if you investigate this in 44 stroke patients and normalizing for arm length and movement duration, then you will find that this jerk, this correction, is mainly happening again in the time frame of spontaneous neurological recovery. This is quality of motor control, and in particular happening in the first 8 weeks after stroke. And now it's interesting to look also to, for example, in a small part of the fMRI, and having this action, but also the exocet arm test and the kinematics simultaneously. We controlled also for mirror movements, because in fMRI it's a helpful thing, because when you're asking a difficult task, patients are doing this or having other movements in the fMRI scanner that you don't like. And what we found is, at least for the amount of improvement in the ischial lesion of cortex and the frontal lesion of cortex, there's a negative association with the exocet arm test, for example, in the Fuchs-Myers score, suggesting better performance on the exocet arm test, less recruitment, not more recruitment, in these patients. But surprisingly, when you look also to the to jerk and smoothness, this is the jerk of the hand opening, there's a strong positive correlation as shown with the fMRI. More recruitment in fMRI, more jerk. And this is found for the jerk of the hands and the different areas in the cerebellum, in the supplementary cortex, also in the contralesional hemisphere. And the same is happening also for the jerk of finger aperture. So jerk is positively associated with the amount of recruitment by fMRI. And we can say it another way, less, more ballistic, more normal movement is associated with less recruitment in the affected and the non-affected hemisphere. High correlation conditions. And the question is, how do we explain this? And this is a parallel to what's found by Nick Ward, for example. The first part of the quality of motor control negatively is associated with activation in fMRI, so nothing new in this. That optimal recovery coincides with patterns of activation seen in healthy subjects. But this is just new. That a high association of activation of fMRI with jerk suggests that these recruited areas reflect an increased dependency on feedback mechanisms. So patients are recruiting from other areas, they don't feel it, they are correcting, they are having a different feedback strategy. Whereas as you are doing this, you have to meet more feed-forward strategy. You're throwing your arm to that, correcting just before you're picking up this block, and you need less recruitment of cortical activation that appears to be precise in your movement control. So what I'm mostly show is in order to understand adaptive motor control, motor learning, you may say there's a reduced control, of course, of cortex, but it's always a matter of restitution and substitution. Behavioral substitution, compensation, adaptation, and there's always adaptive control at the end that defines the task performance at that specific moment. It's a dynamic process, time-dependent already, said by Alexander. And there are two mechanisms behind this: learning and non-learning dependent mechanisms. And the non-learning dependent mechanisms with spontaneous neurological recovery probably to do with salvation of pneumonal tissue, critical areas in the brain, but also elevation diaschesis, probably remote areas of yesterday emphasized by Professor Nudo. And there are learning-dependent mechanisms. that is experience dependent by heavy and anti-heavy learning processes, and maybe enhanced by this growth promoting factors. And now, this is, I think, the key issue we're talking these days about. What we now know is that spontaneous neurological recovery is really for the true neurological recovery, getting back the normal coordination, the degrees of freedom that we are able to control for. Whereas the experience-dependent plasticity, if this error is true, I don't know. But I'm sure patients learn to adapt, to optimize their motor control in the most optimal way. And this is the way that we have shown, but this is the way that has to be discovered in the next future. And if there is a maladaptation, it's also something to discuss for the next decades, I think. So, I'd like to show how we proceed now, because I have a problem, and I think that might be a nice example, and then I'm really finished. How to proceed? What we're now doing is high-density EEG and having this haptic robot in order to control the input what is given to these patients. You exactly know the ventilation that is given to these patients, and you have the high-density EEG. And this is just an example. You see the perturbations here, task performance, task forces, and passive movements. And we like to investigate, of course, plasticity, but I think it's not possible to compare between patients, but you have to do it within the patient, longitudinally in time, because patients are difficult to compare with each other. So we are interested in the longitudinal resting state of these patients, but also the SEPs, how these are evolving as a function of time, and also having this closed-loop identification system, exactly knowing what's the input by this haptic robot, and measuring this EEG activity. I'm doing this not alone, but together with the Technical University of Delft, and we have these serial measurements like explicit as a function of time. It's not a trial, it's just observation, not tuning in time, but also using this kinematics and so on. And the difficulty in these longitudinal designs is always to be on time, fixed times post-stroke. Otherwise, you don't are able to compare these patients with each other. At least, you like to have everybody at 8 weeks or 7 weeks after stroke. So we're traveling through the Netherlands, and this is the reason that we are building this van, and we are now driving with this van through the Netherlands. And in this van, we are parking just in front of the patient, and putting the patient in this paradigm, and having this is in the van, this application. And then we go to our nursing homes, hospitals, or whatever. And you think this might be something fancy or more expensive? It's cheap. Because if I have 50 EEG recordings four times in 6 months, it's more expensive to have a taxi driver that is coming to my polyclinic and measuring these patients. And now I can put my students. And the first question is, of course, do you have your drive license? What do you mean coming for that PhD? So I'd like to thank my research team in this, with the Technical University of Delft again, and also the Chicago Western University is involved in the Children Board. And I'd like to thank you for your attention.
Yesterday we heard about the
Yesterday we heard about the different genotypes affecting the neuroplasticity. Is this one aspect of the pitters and non-pitters as you were referring to?
Very good question and answers. We absolutely don't know. People also in the preclinical setting, Dale Corbett, and everybody's searching now for the markers that may identify. Because if you can identify, you should design the trial in a different way. These patients with non-pitch, they don't show any spontaneous recovery. So no true neurological repair. They are dependent on all compensation strategies that you have. You have a totally different strategy with these patients. And that's I think that this is a game changer, I think, for the next neuro rehab in the future. If this is true, I like to see the implication. There are some indications on top of Biblo and Stenia on the epilim, but I think it's more a general issue. Another nice paper would be if you have this, for example, to look if the patients who are not recovering on dysphagia also not recovering in the brain function, for example, in the left hemisphere. I only showed it in the right hemisphere, but gene expression, we don't know. It's a retrospective phenomenon that we discovered.
Yes,
we
another.
Think?
I tried to ask another what do you think about the design CNSAD experimental design, a well-controlled case studies instead of those very big group studies that perhaps are difficult to perform?
Yeah. I think that's a very good question, also a tough question. Let's give the answer. Single subject designs, in fact, what I'm showing are 100 single subject designs. Because I'm comparing within changes more. Okay, they are randomized, but the within changes are even more interesting. In the single subject design, you are AB or ABC designs. The problem is when you have spontaneous neurological recovery, we are trying to model this spontaneous recovery. It's a nonlinear process. And I don't know mathematics to solve nonlinear issues with single subject designs. So the single subject designs, the main problem mathematically that you have is there should be a stable baseline. A stroke, certainly not. So you can do it after 3 months, I think, single subject, or 6 months, and do it repeatedly, nicely. I think it's a neglected design, but not for the acute. And maybe with some complex growth curve fitting in, but it won't be accepted because people are not accepting nonlinear single subject designs. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yes, and then Luis Ada has a
As someone who designs and tries to carry out clinical trials, one of the things you were talking about is the same time point after stroke. What do you exactly mean by that? How specific do you mean that?
Yeah. Very specific.
Every single person on day 14.
It's also non-linear in the sense of, okay, you have to be more precise in the early.
Yeah.
That's the reason why I designed explicit trial more frequently early, and then it's slowing down because the curve is slowing down. And that's... Alexander already emphasized the patient is so dynamic in the early phase. 3 days later, it's totally a different patient. So we can't compare that anymore. There's a different situation at that moment. Other impairments that are so fairly precise, fairly fixed. Preferably, I'm saying, okay, on the same day. So we have a standard deviation of 2 days in our design. And that's maybe the measures. One of the reasons why I think it does. The animal studies showing a lot of evidence, and the human studies, we don't do it precisely. We should be much more precise. And I'm talking with John Krakauer, he's saying you shouldn't do about 80% of people are doing trials, you should punish them. Don't do it anymore because they are making a mess. That's a total different view, but I can feel his skepticism.
It's very difficult.
It's so difficult. Much more than pharmacological whatever. It's behavior. It's implementation. It's all these.
One final question from you.
Yeah, thank you for a last lecture. You were talking about that there were, in your trials, there are a few that deviate, that actually regain function after 3 months. What sort of studies have been done on that group? Why is it fMRI in biological markers? Is there any studies that have been done on that group? Why some actually do excel after the three months.
In fact not, and we are looking for the exceptions. My personal experience, because in the 90s seeing a lot of patients, hundreds, and following them in time, I have seen exceptions in quite suddenly beyond 6 months. They're not fitting in my model, of course. And what they, you have to be careful. Some patients show apraxia and other cognitive stuff, but they still have, and that's also a thing why TMS might be more a better way to focus on the intactness of the cortical spinal tract system, that you are sure that there's some intactness or not, and if you have they don't know how to perform it, motor pressure, that these patients make an exception, but it's one out of the hundreds, for example, that make exceptions. Maybe we can collect them and say, okay, let's go in for 5 years and collect these exceptions, because I'm very curious.
I think that might be more interesting.
It might be very interesting.
It might be.
And talking about TMS, clinical observation is your strongest play. We now compare 51 patients with TMS and doing this in acute phase for the intactness, and observation is as good as TMS. And if you don't have a TMS response in the adjunctive mini, it's as poor as observing that there's no voluntary response. So just observe very carefully these patients. And even the thump that is going back, that is not a factor. Observation.
Okay. Again, thank you very much. And maybe there are some more questions that people can discuss with you afterwards.
Of course.
You probably
want
to have a lunch.
I have to apologize. I have family medicine. And I'm 1 hour, 1 o'clock, I'm leaving. So it's still
one. So
we're thinking
with the suicide report, you can do it.